So we are studying the book of Genesis, and we are on Genesis 1, verse 20 on page 13 in my book. It's titled Living Creatures. Last week, we finished by discussing three quick little points that we're going to develop a little bit more tonight about why there is no real conflict between scientific theories on creation versus the biblical story on creation. And that is because God, when he created in volume, he created in motion, and he created with implied age. We talked about that last week. So, for instance, when he created in what volume, we're going to get this in a minute, he created the fish, he created a whole ocean full of fish in a moment, not like one fish and then another fish and let them mate for 10,000 years until there's an ocean full of fish. He creates a whole ocean full of fish. And the ocean full of fish are fish that have pre-existing relationships to each other, like a grandfather fish is swimming with his grandson fish next to his wife fish next to his whatever. So God creates an ecosystem when he creates, when he created. So the point is that if you go and use any ordinary measure on the ecosystem that God created, you would say, well, this has been here for thousands of years. And I mean, it's at least been here for 10 years, because look, here's a fish who's got a sunfish and a grandfather fish. You know, I mean, there's just been that much time in there. In other words, there's implied time inside of the way that he creates it. God creates in motion, which means that like he says, he flung out the stars or whatever. So he creates the planets revolving around the various suns and all the interactions going on. You got to remember that God had to create a scenario where these planets all revolve in such a way as not to crash into each other. If you were to take about 8 or 9 or 10 pool balls and spread them on the table, and then take the cue ball and just fling it, you know, what is the chance that it would go all the way through all those balls and never touch each other? You know, not good. But that's what God had to do. He had to create in such a way that there were, you know, tens of millions of pool balls out on the table with all of these things interacting with each other in such a way as to never encounter each other. So he's creating, that's part of the mass design. He's creating in motion. So when it says, for instance, that that star is 183 light years away, what that's implying on a scientific level is that that light actually shone first 183 light years ago, and it is just getting to us now. But if God's creating in motion, then he's creating stuff, light on the way, light on the way a little bit, light on the way, light just coming, about ready to arrive. As far as that goes, if he creates deer walking through a forest, at the moment he creates them, this deer is approaching that glen. You see what I'm saying? So, I mean, the other way that you would think of it is okay, he goes and he creates a pen full of deer, and then he goes, okay, y'all go take off now. But that's not what's implied in it at all. God's creating ecosystems in motion and in volume. And then the one we used about applied time, it's all of it, applied time's in all of it, but the one we used about applied time is if you saw God create Adam and Eve one day, and the next day you brought a team of scientists in and they did a full-on physical of Adam and Eve, all their instruments would measure that they are 25 years old, have been through puberty, have developed this or that. You would see evidence of development from earlier stages until this. You'd see the evidences of a childhood they never had, because God creates with implied time. Otherwise, when they got ready to procreate, all of us would be missing childhood genes. We'd all be missing all that stuff. But the point is God creates them. The example I like to use is when we were kids, we talked about Superman having the ability to take a coal, and pressurize it until it becomes a diamond. You know, remember? So the point would be is that what causes diamonds is carbon under pressure over time. All right. So what happens is Superman could take that and he would just squeeze it hard enough that eventually what you have left is a diamond. Well, it's kind of like God saying, how old would you like this world to be? You know, 10,000 years, 100,000 years, 100 million years, whatever. He creates it, God creates it by design with an implied history And no one ever said differently. No one ever implied differently. In fact, you couldn't do it any other way. If you stopped and thought about it, you're going to create a world, you know. It's kind of like you can't create a leaf until you create a tree. And you can't create a tree until you create a root system. And you can't create a root system until you have an earth to put it in. In other words, you have to create a developed system all at one time. Now, one of the basic scientific laws for many, many years until about the last decade is that everything that exists is reducible to some singular piece. And you put the singular pieces together, they become multidimensional systems. Okay, so they are so therefore everything is irreducible to individual pieces. So if you take the human body, the idea is that we're all reducible down to cells. Okay, well, one of the things that they have discovered in the last decade or so, because of the cellular research and because of the DNA and all that sort of thing, is there are neuromotor systems in the body that are irreducible, and yet they're complex. So, for instance, there are certain neuromotors that make our body work and function, make our neurons work as they do, that they can now identify, but they cannot be reduced to pieces. In other words, there were complex structures to begin with. And that just throws, just that piece alone, throws a bowling ball through the whole process of evolution as it is suggested in terms of creation. So it's not important that we win this argument with people. It's only important that we understand that the argument's there. When we get to heaven, we're going to see for sure, you know, what happened. It's not important to be right. It's just rationally necessary for us to know that something can happen, that there is a logical explanation that works and fits. So when we read the Word of God and it says this happened, we have no reason to believe that it didn't happen just the way that it did. And the number one reason that is suggested by the people who don't want to read God into our world is that the creation implies all these vast ages. Well, you know, there's nothing wrong with that, because when God creates it, He creates an implied time. Bring on the carbon dating. It's going to reflect the vast ages, but that doesn't mean it wasn't created yesterday. You know, if you do carbon dating on anything God created the day after it was created, the testing is going to show that it has existed for vast ages. You see? All right. So that's how we kind of wrapped up last week, and we're going to sort of take off at the kind of same place again. We're talking about the creation of the living creature, starting in Genesis 1:20. Then God said, "Let the waters teem with swarms of living creatures, and let the birds fly above the earth in the open expanse of the heavens." You know, He didn't say, "Okay, I'm going to create a bird, and then I'm going to throw it up in the thing and hope it flies." He created birds in flight and fish in motion, teeming. He created teams. Ecosystems. God created the great sea monsters and every living creature that moves with which the waters swarmed after their kind, and every winged bird after its kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, and saying, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters in the seas. Let the birds multiply on the earth." There was evening, there was morning, a fifth day. So in one day He creates all the birds, all the fish, fills the sea, the swarming, fills the skies, fills the earth with birds, etc., etc. Then God said, "Let the earth bring forth living creatures after their kind, cattle, creeping things, beasts of the earth after their kind." And it was so, and God made the beasts of the earth after their kind, and the cattle after their kind, everything that creeps on the ground after its kind. And God saw that it was good. So inside this one day, He creates all the living things. He creates the birds, the fish, the animals that crawl on the ground, the worms that crawl. All this sort of thing. And when He got done with this one day, there was a fully developed ecosystem. Thousands upon thousands of birds and fishes and worms and deer and opossums and all kinds of strange marsupials. You know, God's got a sense of humor. The animals were created in volume and with a generational history. The waters and skies teem with fish and birds. The earth teem with animals, with relationship and place. There were the animals had fathers, mothers, offspring, cousins, etc. Mother-in-laws. There's already family arguments going on. Actually, didn't have any at this particular point in time. That doesn't come till after the fall. But after the fall, a lot of them come into place. What we have before the fall is the triune collegiality that is a reflection of God's existence. So we have the people getting along, people living in harmonious mutual support and love. And that would include the animals. It would include the animals and man. So there weren't any mother-in-law spats at this particular point in time. And there certainly weren't any animals eating other animals. No animal had to be afraid that it was going to be eaten by anyone. Now these that he created were sentient creatures versus angels, creatures of reason. Now remember, he hasn't created man yet. We haven't got that far. Okay. So sentient creatures. Sentient denotes feelings or sensation versus perception or thought. So the animals are sentient creatures. The angels are perceptual creatures. So the angels represent the perceptual side of God's creation. The animals represent the sensual side of God's creation. And humans are going to be a combination of both when we get there. That's why the humans are God's greatest work, because it takes from that which is the perceptual beings that he created and that which is the sentient beings he created and brings them together into one being, and in doing so causes them to reflect his own nature. So when he creates the angels, when he creates the, which were pre-created, when he creates the animals, he's actually creating beings with parts of his nature, pieces of his nature. Now, and angels left their estate to experience the sentient world. There are some unique scriptures in Jude and Genesis and 2 Peter that said that there were angels who saw the sentient world, wanted to participate in it, and violated the boundaries of their perceptual world in order to be able to experience the sentient world. And in doing so, they created great sin. And for this, they were locked away into the abyss. Yes?
Senses,
that's right.
Touch.
Yeah, that's
see.
Right. Right, having physical touch, feel, smell, all those sort of things. It denotes feelings or sensation versus perception or thought. I mean, that's just basic human science or natural science. Okay. So what we have with animals is a kind of a creature that operates in a sentient world or sensual world versus the angels, who are a kind of creature that operates in a perceptual world but has no sentient components. Angels can't feel things, they can't touch, they can't smell. They can perceive but not see. They don't have eyes. They have perception. Remember, there's illumination and then there's light.
Give an example of perception then when the angels.
Well, the angels have the ability to operate within our world, but they cannot sense or feel anything. So what happens is they are limited to perceptual reality. They don't have sensual reality.
So they can perceive that we're happy or sad?
Yeah. Yeah, they can see, but not with physical eyes, not with eyes that sense in the way that they don't have rods and cones. They don't have all that sort of thing. Remember, neither does God.
Yeah.
So the point is that they're quite capable of walking among us, understanding what's going on around us without any senses at all.
So that makes them spiritual.
Yeah, it makes them spiritual or perceptual.
And averting calamities that we might be walking into.
Pardon? Yeah, they can intervene in our world in lots of different ways. You know, what we know about that would fit in a thimble, but they obviously do. They're mostly in the Bible given to messaging. The word angel means messenger, and that's mostly what they do in the Bible. You know, we know, for instance, that the angel that blocked Balaam's donkey threatened to slay Balaam. So we know they have certain kinds of capacity to do things, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they would do it with a physical sword. I mean, they wouldn't do it with a physical sword.
And say again, what happened to the angels that violated their boundaries?
Well, what happened is that these angels saw the sentient world, and they wanted to participate in it. And most notably what they saw was the sexual activity with women. And because of what they saw and observed there, they lusted in their heart to participate in it. And so what they did was they violated their boundaries and found ways to participate in that. Now, how that actually works is a little up in the air. It either works from the standpoint of they possessed, demon-possessed people in order to experience it through them that way, which is the most likely way to do that. Or they found some way to cross the border between perceptual and sensual, which we wouldn't know how that works just yet. We do know, though, two things. One is that they did it. They were caught doing it, and it was such a huge violation that those who did it were immediately imprisoned and are not among us. They're in the abyss. They were sent to the abyss for the offense. Well, the abyss is a holding place until hell comes along. Okay, it's a part of Sheol. But yeah, that's right. It's a permanent sentence. They won't be released. They'll go from there to hell when we get to hell. But the other part of the equation is that in some way or another, they generated the Anak, the giants, the people, the Nephilim. The Nephilim were a race of giants that were generated through the interaction between women and angels. And how that happens or happened, the Bible doesn't give us any detail, but it tells us that it does. So,
Goliath
was one of the sons of Anak. That's right. Generational, descendant of Anak. There is a number of references all the way down into Joshua and his people killed the last of the Anak. Joshua and you know, it gets down to the age of time of David, and there's very few of these people left. There's Goliath and his brother, you know, as far as we know of. But Joshua and his people wiped out the Anak. Remember that when the spies went into the land, they came back and they said the Anak or the Nephilim are among them. Well, when Joshua and them went in, Caleb in particular destroyed the sons of Anak. And so what you had left in is you had genetic mutants that popped up from that point on, Goliath being one of them. Goliath was a little giant. Moving on. Everybody else gets here. All right. Jude was written to confront those who corrupt God's intent in creation and denigrate the physical world through libertine abuse of the physical and the resulting reaction, asceticism, and what's the other word? No, not ascetical Gnosticism, but asceticism and word escapes me. There are two ways that the Greeks denied Stoicism. Asceticism and Stoicism, okay. So, when Jude was written, he was talking to people who were taking sensual pleasure to an extraordinarily high perverted level. And he quotes about the angels doing such things and that God imprisoned them for it. It's one of the places where that's referenced. One of the problems that we have as human beings is that we want to take the sensual and make it into a worship thing. We want to overemphasize the sensual. Like, for instance, we're meant to have food pleasure, but we're not meant to be so enamored with it that we just go crazy and we wind up becoming hedonistic around food, where food becomes an idol to us. Same thing's true with sex pleasure or... I mean, you know, there are actually people who work out in inappropriate ways because of the highs they get off of it and whatever. So all of the physical world is meant to be a blessing to us, but none of it is meant to become a god to us or be taken to an immoral level. There are boundaries around all the things of God, and people take pain, for instance, to wrong levels. You know, it's right. Pain's good because you got to know if your hand's in the fire, take it out of the fire. But if you, you know, beat yourself and all this kind of stuff just in order to maximize your pain, you're violating boundaries. What happens is pain becomes pleasure, as it were. So one of the problems we have as human beings is that we take different aspects of what God gave us when creation, and we make them more important than they should. We cross boundaries with them. And Jude was written to deal with hedonists and those people responding to hedonism who wanted to promote asceticism and stoicism. Remember that the Greeks proposed, most many of them, that the physical world was evil and the spiritual world was good. And so what happened is they came up with several therefores. Therefore, since the physical is going to pass and the spiritual will live on, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. In other words, just enjoy the physical all you want, because once we're dead, it passes, it's no big deal. That produces the Epicureanism, the hedonists. Then other people said, no, it's evil, and you don't want to enjoy the physical world, because if you do, it'll pollute your spiritual world. You won't be able to develop spiritually because of all the distraction from the physical world. And so they developed Stoicism and asceticism, which denied the joys of the physical world to the point of saying what God had created was bad. But the Hebrews, I mean, tell us, you know, that's one of the reasons why we have such a, we're going to get to this in just a minute, about celibacy and stuff like that. But one of the reasons we have this struggle in Christianity along certain lines is because the Greeks polluted the Christian theology after the time of Constantine, because Constantine, remember, was a Greek. And when he caused Christianity to become the world's required, demanded religion for everyone, he also required the theologians to open up to the thoughts of all other pagan cultures and beliefs, including the Greeks, and so all that stuff began to pour into the church. The Roman church was particularly polluted by it. If you go to Rome, go to the Vatican, go to Sistine Chapel, go to walk through the path, any of that area, what you will see, and it'll strike you, is that for every picture, icon, or statue of something spiritual, there is at least one or two more of the pagan gods, the Roman gods, all the various gods and goddesses. So they blended all that together. And you can't walk through the Vatican, the Sistine Chapel, all the hallways, or even the square out front, without seeing this syncretism between the Roman and Greek gods and the biblical characters and stuff like that. So Moses and Zeus are, you know, two equally appreciated beings. If you take your cue from the Hebrew, you see that God created this and it was good. And when he created man and woman, it was very good. So God's telling us what's good. The Greeks are telling us it's bad. Right? So we take our cue from God and we realize that this is good. The physical world is good. The human world is good. The world that God gave us that is pleasurable and joyous is good. It's got to have boundaries, you know. Nothing can become more important than God. So therefore, what we see is a conflict between certain Christian theologies and what the Bible has to say. So we need to take our cue from the Hebrews, not from the Greeks. The Greeks had some things right, but they were never the progenitor of God's thinking. Aristotle, for instance, told us that way back before all this, that we were body, soul, and spirit. Life after death, all manner of things the Greek philosophers came up with. Many of them were right. Some Greek philosophers were pre-Christian. Some Greek philosophers later were Christian and Greek philosophers, and their philosophies were good theology. But some weren't. They were contradictory. So one of the problems people have is when they abandon the Old Testament and just read the New Testament, like Marcion and many people today, what they're doing is they're absorbing all the Greek influences and without the counterbalance of the Hebrew influences. So what happens is we wind up getting a skewed look at what Christianity is about. So you know, the Jews, l'chaim to life. You know, we're meant to enjoy this, to l'chaim. There is a Hebrew word for life, chaim, C-H-A-Y-I-M. L'chaim means to the life. And then there's a word nefesh. Nefesh means just a living soul. That kind of living, the life-like, you know, not dead. Whereas l'chaim means abundant life. In the Greek, you have the same two words, the same two kinds of words. You have psyche, P-S-Y-C-H-E, which means life. And you have zoe, which means abundant life. So the word zoe means, Jesus said, I've come to give you life and life more abundantly. Zoe. Not psyche. You see? So, Jesus himself tells us that he wants us to have zoe. If he were speaking Hebrew, he would have said, l'chaim. All right, moving on. The Bible is supportive of all physical life and its enjoyment within boundaries. And God saw that it was good. Okay? After every bit of creation, he said, this is good. Greek asceticism, the body is bad thinking, corrupted the church's thinking, resulting in inappropriate celibacy, fallacious sexual beliefs, and perversion, including like St. Augustine. Augustine was a libertine. He was a person who just was absolutely sex mad. And he had a mistress and a son. And Augustine wrestled with his own heart and at one particular point in time had a conversion experience. When he had this conversion experience and he recognized his need for God, he began to deny any and all sexual activity or the enjoyment of anything sexual as evil. He abandoned his lover and took his son and went and off to become a Christian. He became a bishop in Hippo and then became one of the great written theologians of the age. Augustine was a great teacher, but he was impacted negatively by his own libertinism that caused him to think of all sexual creation or all sexual pleasure as evil. And so much of the church's attitude about celibacy and, you know, beating yourself with whips and all that sort of thing comes from the corrupted teaching of its theologians, including, chief among them, Augustine. It's interesting because Martin Luther was a very earthy man, and Martin Luther used to, his sermons were very interesting to read, but you know, Martin Luther was a guy who would talk about the, you know, he married this Augustinian nun, and they had all his kids, and he was just robust about talking about how great it was that God created, you know, food to eat and, you know, whatever. Martin Luther would do a sermon and talk about the beauties of a good dump. He was earthy. Well, you know what? If you ever read any of the sermons of the Puritans, you'll be shocked at what you read. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Because they invented some words that we think are pretty awful today. Yeah. I'll give you a quick example. I'll let you read between the lines. When a person got caught stealing, they were putting stocks in the public squares. And above their head, it was said that they were in there for theft. So the people going by would know why they were being in, you know, prison. They'd be embarrassed. If they were caught in adultery or in fornication unmarried, they were put in stocks and above their head it would be foreign lawful carnal knowledge. Well, that got to be too hard to spell, so they just shortened it up. Okay? And in their sermons from the pulpit, and you can read them, they say, we've got to stop doing all this and no more of this and this. That was a word they created, which we consider to be the F word, you know, the four-letter word. But it was a church word. It was a church word. So, anyway, moving on. Well, you know, Domino Gay Apparel used to be that it was talking about joyous and whatever. Now it means cross-dressing. So words change their meaning. All righty.
Hey, Wayne, on that note, can I ask a question?
Sure, sure.
This is totally off what you're talking about.
That's probably on purpose, but yeah, go ahead.
But no, I had a question about the animals.
Yeah.
Okay. It said here he did the fish and the birds on the fifth day. And it says evening and morning, fifth day.
Yeah.
And then it says then he started creating all the animals. And then down here below, it just starts talking about him creating man. So were the animals and man
operated
on the
6th? No, they were on the 5th day also. You can't get hung up in the word order. If you read the Hebrew text, all you got to do is go look at the interlinear Hebrew text, and what you'll see is a group of words just spread out all over a page, and you have to go put them all together in terms of context. All Hebrew words are three-letter verbs. And in order to create nouns, they have to hang verbs together in order to suggest a noun. Hebrew is so inexact, they don't do contracts in Hebrew. In Israel, they do them in French or in English now. But Hebrew, like all Arabic languages, is pictorial. It's like cave writing. So sometime get your Bible study program out. If you're a serious Bible student, you ought to have something like PC Bible Study. For helping you find information about stuff like that. And go to the interlinear translation. Go to any interlinear translation. You can find them in books. You can go to the library and get them. Go online and get them. Go to any interlinear translation of Hebrew, of the Hebrew text that has both the English and the Hebrew on the same page. And what it looks like is, instead of saying, Bereshit Hashemayim, Haaretz or something like that, which is in the beginning was the heavens and the earth, it'll have Hashemayim will come first and Haaretz will come and then Bereshit or whatever, and it'll say something like earth, heaven, beginning, in. I mean, that's how it reads. If you use the Hebrew order and went straight into English, that's how it would read. And so sometimes you have to look all around to figure out what's modifying what. So you can't do that. I'll give you a good example. Ichabod Shula Gigan. Okay? I have to the school gone. Well, if you're speaking German has a word order that's altogether unique from English. What you have is an auxiliary verb up front, and then your real verb is at the end. So Ichaba, I have. Shula, to the school Gigan, gone. We say, I've gone to school. They go, I have to the school gone. I caused the window to be opened, the word order is different in languages, and people just have to learn how to contextually and culturally reorganize things in order to say it in your language. So, this is all part of the fifth day. It's just, he brought the summary line in and then said, oh, by the way, sort of like, there's also the animals and whatever. Okay? You didn't want to cover you again? Okay. All right. To live like an animal simply means to live totally based in feelings without the balance of reason. So when we say someone lives like an animal, we're just saying that they are living totally based in feelings without the balance of reason. Be fruitful and multiply, he says to them. God is the author of prosperity. God is the author of have a good time, become prosperous, do well, have joy, have life. Verse 26, then God said, let us make man in our image. See the us there? We will see that many, many times. But it points to the triune nature of God. Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness, see the our. And let them rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky, over the cattle and over all the earth and over all the creeping things that creep on the earth. God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created them. Male and female created them. And God blessed them and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth, subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and every living thing that moves on the earth. So now God creates a steward for all this creation. And he tells them to be fruitful and multiply, but he also tells them to rule over the earth, or to steward the earth. And so all that he's made before comes under the stewardship, rulership of this creature that he's made here on the sixth day. Now God, let me just go on to the summary because I'll just repeat myself. So God created man in his image to rule as a steward and for fellowship. So he needed someone to steward the creation he made, and he also created man for the purposes of fellowship between him and man. Man is the ultimate goal. God is like any other good being who has and wishes to share. One of the reasons why people want children is because they want to share the life they have. They want to, you know, they want to pass, they want to enjoy it with a community of their own making. And so God is the ultimate father and mother, all kind of all wrapped in one. And so he wants to share this great existence that he has, and he has to create a whole new ecosystem called time and space in order to create a being that he can share it with. So up until then, he's got angels running around the place, but sharing the creation or sharing his existence with angels is not satisfying enough to God. He wants to share it at a higher level than he can share it with angels. And so what he does is he creates the time continuum, space continuum, puts in it all of these, the earth and the water and the heavens and all the planets and all this kind of stuff. Creates the plants and the animals and all the sustaining systems above to make those things go so that we get the vegetation, so the animals can eat, etc., etc., so that it's properly warm. Remember, if you're just 2 degrees closer to any sun, you're either on fire, 2 degrees away, you're iced over. You know, the earth had to be exactly where it was in relationship to the sun for there to be a habitat that was possible for human or animal existence. Otherwise they'd all freeze. They'd be a frozen planet like the ones that are, or they'd be too hot like the ones that are too close. So God creates all of this in order to create a being with whom he can share his existence. Man, made in his image, kind of like a child is made in the image of its parents. Exactly like that, actually. So a man was created in two forms or parts, male or female, each reflecting part of God's nature, each a composite of angels and animals, and each seeking or desiring the other. So it's kind of like the a magnetism. You know, you've got a plus and a negative that are trying to meet. You know, there's a draw there. So what you have is man is made in male and female. They're made also sentient and perceptual or spiritual, and they're designed to want to come together, because that actual, you know, it says when he created, he said, God created man his own image, in the image of God he created him, male and female he created them. So the real image of God, man in the real image of God, is actually male and female together, is the full image of God. Male's a reflection of God, female's a reflection of God. The Bible frequently speaks of God as a he, but not always. The Lord is referred to as the breast, for instance. It's the nurturing part of God. And there are other places. God's wisdom is often referred to as she. So the nature of God is spoken of in both male and female ways, as if it had gender, male and female. It doesn't have either. But. So physical drive is designed by God and is intended to teach us intimacy and right relationship. Intimacy is intended to lead us to grow in godlikeness. So the reason why the physical drive was given was to teach us intimacy, because intimacy is the nature of God in triune community. It is godlikeness. Now remember, we had these problems with these people in Jude who were taking all of these things out of their boundaries and polluting them. Okay, well, this is the problem. The problem is there's been so much misuse of God's creation of intimacy, physical and spiritual intimacy, that it has created all these perverse things. Corrupted man perverts everything with the help of the devil who's trying to pervert God's world. But the intention of God is to create these things for very good purposes. Once again, we go back to the Hebrews because they get it, whereas the Greeks don't. The concept that the body is, or the physical world is evil, is contrary to the biblical claim that it is good. Intimacy is intended to lead us to grow in godlikeness. If by it we develop both the capacity and the appreciation for harmony, mutual love and concern, cooperative creativity, proper stewardship within a Trinitarian community. Now, I tell people all the time when I'm doing weddings that every marriage is a triune community. There's the husband, the wife, and a third party. And when the third party is God, then that triune community flows in harmony. When the third party is Satan, or your mother-in-law, or somebody's best friend, that whole thing is wrecked. That's why we're supposed to abandon all other relationships and come together with God, the three of us together. And anytime there's a third party in a marriage that's not God, it's wrong. I don't care how wonderful it may seem. You know, mama does not belong in the marriage. There's a whole lot of marriages that went south because somebody never left home. So when Nancy and I get to scrapping or something, and we realize because of our training that we're suddenly at odds with each other, we have to stop and clear out the third chair and put God back in the third chair, because what's happening is that something else is in the third chair, Satan or somebody else, that is actually causing us to come against each other. We put God. We can't fight. We can't fight. It's just not possible, because when God is in the third chair, we must agree to forgive. We must agree to talk it out. We must agree to do these things. Our relationship, all of us as Christians, the call in our life to forgive, to be selfless, to prefer the person, whatever, those are commandments. Those aren't suggestions. These aren't the 10 suggestions. Those are commandments. So when we put God in the third chair, we're acknowledging His sovereignty, and then we either run to absolute obedience or absolute rebellion. What happens when we say, I am not forgiving you, or you, or whatever, is we're saying God can go suck a rock. That's what we're saying. So even though we cling to our anger or hatred or bitterness toward another person, it's really aimed at God, because He has commanded us. God commands a blessing. God commands harmony. He speaks it into existence, okay? So if Bob and I, in our relationship, are a triune community, me, Bob, and a third person, all communities are triune. And the triune community of heaven is reflected in our relationships. So when we are created in God's image, we're also created in triunity, the collegiality of the triune community, where they were all equal but all served one another. That's why the whole issue of submission is always mutual. It's never one person dominates another. It's mutual submission in which all are both primary and subservient at the same time. Real respectful submission in a triune community causes everyone to be worthy in the community, not one person being denigrated by another. So, are you with me? So, when God creates us here, He's not creating us just as male or female. He's creating us as the two of us together with Him in exact reflection of His of who He is. Because who God is this triune community. Let me move on here, because I don't want to get this totally philosophical. All right. We are also created to prosper. There is nothing evil about prosperity. Prosperity is perfected in stewardship, but corrupted in ownership. Prosperity is perfected in stewardship, but corrupted in ownership. If God gives me money or goods, whatever, and I relate to it as a steward, and I use it for the purposes that God gave me. He gave me this money to buy a house for my family. He gave me this money to buy a car. He gave me this money to take care of this person who was in need. He gave me this money to take care of this ministry. He gave me this money. This money here goes back to him to care for the Levites. This money, it all has a purpose. God has no bank account. He stores all of his money in our accounts. And when God gets ready to do something for anybody in the earth, he has to go draw it out of our accounts. And every one of us, no matter what the size of our bank account is, have resources in it that belong to God. And our job is to figure out, what does God want me to do with those resources? Prosperity is perfected in stewardship. If we have the right stewardship mentality, we can be rich as Carlesus. John Wesley made the equivalent of about $160,000 a year in today's money, because he was a prolific writer and he sold his writings. In those days, people sold what they called tracts. They would write a treatise and they would sell them for like a penny a piece. A penny was worth more then. And John Wesley made on average about what we would about $160,000 a year, and he died with about $38 in his pocket. John Wesley said we should make all we can, save all we can, and give all we can. And by save, he meant don't spend it on stuff that isn't necessary. In other words, buy the necessary and put the rest of it back to be stewarded for what God wants you to do. He did not mean hoard. He meant of the money that we've been given, use what little is necessary for that which is necessary, and the rest should be set back aside for use in God's kingdom, whether it was on ourselves or someone else as God directed. So prosperity is of God, perfected in stewardship, but corrupted in ownership. It leads to, when it's corrupted in ownership, it leads to the idolatry known as consumerism. The idea of purchasing things for the sake of purchasing things. Because consumerism becomes the God, just buying stuff. Again, physicality is to be balanced by reason. Correct reason is found only in the light of God. So we're now full circle in the 6 days of creation. Illumination came first. Okay? And all of this which came later has to be operated within illumination. Remember, illumination is reason, structure, you know, truth. And all of this without illumination goes south. In the light of God, it all is a wonderful thing. There was meant to be a balance between the physical and the rational. The physical life is good when lived in God's illumination. Prosperity is good when lived in God's illumination. The world is good when operated in God's illumination. Puritans, and it should say extreme Puritans, and ascetics and other faithless people try to deny physicality and prosperity in order to avoid making mistakes. You run into people down through history who say, we don't allow any of that because people just mess it up. You know, this tends to evil, so we don't allow any of it. They bury their talent in the ground rather than take the risk to which we are all called. We are all called to go at risk with what God gives us, the steward. That means you're going to have failures. You're going to have successes and failures, trial and error. We learn by those things. God is not poor. He can afford us to make some mistakes. You know, it's not like that the resources of God are so scarce that if we screw up something and something gets wasted, that the heavens are shaken. God gives us stuff over time, and the opportunity to work it, trial and error, figure it out, make mistakes, but learn and grow and become good stewards. Okay, that's why children should be given certain amounts of money they can steward and use. They should earn it, and they should learn how to steward it and manage it. If you just give them unlimited supplies and they have no reason to govern it, all they're going to learn is selfishness. If you give them nothing, they will never be able to figure out what to do with it when they get it. One of the really sad stories of, I don't know, probably most generations, but certainly in our generation, was that many people raised their children in hothouses. because they were trying to avoid the world, they stuck their kids off in Christian schools and wouldn't let them fellowship with people in the world and kept them in really tight little hothouses. The community Nancy and I grew up in had a tendency to do this. The kids were always kept within the confines of other kids within the community, and people were not allowed to get out and do much. They went to these real tight little schools. They weren't allowed to fellowship much with kids from other belief systems, et cetera, et cetera. There were parents who did that because they were afraid their kids would go south. What happened was, is the first time these children ever got a chance for trial and error to figure anything out was when they went off to college. And so we had an unusual number of kids who went off to college, got pregnant, flunked out of school, got addicted to drugs, got in trouble with the law. Because their very first experiences at trying to figure out how to deal with life happened at that late date, and it went as very expensive. Nancy and I used to say to Nancy, we need to have our children need to struggle early and often, because when the children are young and they're making mistakes, the consequences are far less expensive than they are when they're making those decisions for the first time when they're 18, 19, 20 years old, and they've never tried or experienced or failed in any way whatsoever. So they don't know what the consequences are. They don't understand that. So,
well, that's alive and well today.
I mean, yeah.
Every little league everybody has to have a trophy because somebody fails.
Mm-hmm. It manifests itself in lots of ways. But what it is overprotective parents trying to keep their children from having the real life experiences that actually teach them balance. It's once again boundaries.
You're afraid of hurting your self-esteem, so
that's right.
The pendulum has swung from one extreme to the
other. When I grew up, they weren't afraid of hurting your self-esteem.
Hey, think about yourself.
Well, but Nancy's right about the pendulum. Nancy's right about the pendulum, because today we have parents put no boundaries at all on their children. So they're watching stuff on TV they shouldn't be seeing. They're out messing around with stuff they shouldn't be doing. So, you know, there's boundaries. I mean, there's balance. Stewardship. See? That's the issues of stewardship. So we are given life, reason, and light, or illumination of God. It is our calling or job to enter into and win the race, to fight the fight, seek and find God, and to find that intimacy that leads to godlikeness. That is why God created all that He had made. He wants us to become like God. A man was created in a physical world, a time-space world, so that he might have the ability to develop. You can't change in eternity. You can't develop in eternity. He had to create the time-space world so that he could start off from scratch and grow and develop his choices, and making the choices, making mistakes, whatever, so that he can eventually get to the place where man becomes like God because he chooses to, because he wishes to, because he sees the good in it, because he acknowledges the superiority of God, the latitude of God, because he acknowledges who God is, and he chooses to emulate him as a matter of honor and because it's the right thing. What God gets out of this is someone who comes into fellowship with him, who acknowledges who he is and the wisdom and beauty and correctness of all that he has made and all that he is. Okay? Man wins because there is the opportunity to fail. Free will gives man the opportunity to win. It also creates an environment where people can fail. But without the ability to fail, man could never win, and God could never have anyone to share his eternity with. So, even the angels fell.
Fear has a tendency to expedite learning.
Pardon? Yeah. Yeah, and that's right. And it's like anything. Chronic pain is toxic, but a certain amount of pain is good. Chronic failure is toxic. You know, we need to. If you run across somebody who's having nothing but failure, you need to help them have some success. But creating a scenario where your child can have nothing but success and no failure is toxic also. All right, moving on. Then God said, "Behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the surface of all the earth, and every tree which has fruit yielding seed. It shall be for food for you, and every beast of the earth, and every bird of the sky, to everything that moves on the earth, which has life. I have given Aver a green plant for food. So the green plants were meant to be food for man and animals, and that was meant to be their food. And it was so. And God saw all that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. So in the process of creating man and the stewardship around man, he said man was very good, not just good. We and the animals were created as vegetarians. The animals were not given to us as food until after the flood. The first animals to be killed were killed by God to provide clothing for Adam and Eve as a result of their sin. Death coming to the world because of sin.
You said the animals were killed by God?
Yep. God provided them with clothing, right?
I don't know. I didn't read it. I just read that they hid themselves to begin with.
Yeah. God had to provide them with clothing. And that meant that animals had to die.
So Adam and Eve didn't kill them?
Adam and Eve would not have known how.
That's true.
They would have known how. Remember that as soon as sin enters in the world, God begins to require the death of lambs.
Right.
That produces for them skins and stuff like that.
But he could have made them clothes without killing the animals, couldn't he?
Well, he.
And I wonder why he did it that way.
You have to ask him.
Next time you see him.
Yeah, I mean,
seriousness of sin.
The wages of sin is death, and it is. We're meant to understand the horror of sin because of the way it produces death, death in us, and death in everything around us. I suppose God could have created linen and made clothes, but that isn't what he did. God can do a lot of things. But he didn't. And he's probably wise that he didn't. I mean, probably it's a reason why that. I mean, he took Ben when he was 17. I don't know why he took Ben when he was 17, but I'm pretty sure he had a good reason. So, I understand your point, but there's two things. It is sometimes relevant to ask the question, but what's more relevant is to accept what the answer is, and then figure out why later. Is that fair?
That was the first shed blood, right?
Yeah. There's I've been doing Leviticus, Numbers, and I'm getting ready to do Deuteronomy. And one of the really heavy things to see in Leviticus and Numbers, this is when God is explaining to the people of Israel things about sacrifices and coming into the temple and not approaching. And there are people dropping over dead from approaching God the wrong way, whatever. God has to create in man, has to teach man what's serious and important and what's not. And the process of doing that is pretty brutal because man cannot afford to approach God in wrong ways. You understand? So when you read Leviticus, Exodus 2, but Leviticus and Numbers, one of the things you see is God has to teach people a culture in which they come to understand who he is, the attitude of latitude and gratitude, understand who he is, how to properly approach him for their own benefit so that they can approach God in a way that's beneficial to them as opposed to, I tell you what it's kind of like. It's kind of like handing somebody who doesn't know how to drive the keys to a fast car and just letting them drive down the road. They'll kill themselves. So you have to teach them how to drive so they don't kill themselves. You know what I'm saying? So one of the things that we see is that in when he is teaching the nation of Israel how to quit being a nation of hedonistic slaves who a long time ago forgot their relationship with the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And their vague memory. I mean, some of the people, yeah, but as a rule. He has to teach a nation of slaves how to live before him. Remember, they come up on the mountain, they get struck dead, and they start getting too friendly with God in ways that aren't appropriate. They get struck dead. They look into the tabernacle, the Ark of the Covenant, they get struck dead. God has to teach people He has to teach us, prepare us in order to be able to approach him right. Especially corrupted people who are not Adam and Eve, whose corruption causes them to do the wrong thing. Okay? He intentionally... Remember Adam, remember Cain is offering fruits and vegetables? God says that's not acceptable. He intentionally introduces into man the death of the lamb. You know, one of the things you have to remember is that in the sacrifices that Abel and Seth and all these people made, the meat went to God. And so it became, in effect, the food of the gods. And so it became sin to eat the meat, which is the food of the gods. You remember Eli? Remember Eli was the prophet of God and the high priest at the time when Samuel was a little boy?
Yeah.
Remember Eli was an older man and his sons were bad men?
Yeah.
And they were taking women out of the sanctuary and having sex with them. One of the things that they would do is they would come to the pots when the sacrifice was being made. And they would stick their fork in and take the stuff that was reserved for God. Or they would take the meat that hadn't been drained to the blood. Or they would take the fatty portions that belonged to God and take them home for their dinners. It was a gross violation of what God had told them they needed to do. You remember that was one of the things that they did that they weren't supposed to do. And of course God struck them dead over the issue. The meat, and then later, after God sort of gives them meat to eat, certain portions of the meat were the food of the God, food of God, and for people to presume to do that was a problem. Alrighty. So the first animals we killed were killed by God to provide clothing for Adam and Eve. The wages of sin is death. Including the death of animals. All this will be restored to them in the millennial reign. In millennial reign, lions will eat straw like the ox and lay down with the lamb in peace. The child will play in the adder's den. They will do no harm on my holy mountain, says the Lord. The ravages of the flood create an increasing unsafe world that requires a higher level of protein. Sinfulness puts barriers between us and God, and us and the animals, between us and the earth. It is the destruction of the Rakia that causes God to tell man they can eat animals. We'll get to that when we get to chapter 6. Well, let's get to part of it now. Genesis 9:1. And God blessed Noah and his sons, and he said, "Be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. The fear of you and the terror of you shall be on every beast of the earth, on every bird of the sky, and everything that creeps on the ground, and all the fish of the sea, and into your hand they are given. Every moving thing that is alive shall be food for you. I shall give all to you as I gave the green plant. Only you shall not eat the flesh with its life, that is, its blood." So the change happens in Genesis 9. And it happens because of the destruction of the Rakia, which, as I said, we'll get to when we get to Genesis 6. Isaiah 11.
Okay, so this means that, I guess it means they can eat everything, and then in what Deuteronomy he gives them the laws.
That's correct. They can eat everything but the blood, up until the time we get to 1400 BC on Mount Sinai, and then they are given rules about what to eat, what not to eat. He's creating a nation of people, and he would like for them, you know, not to be diseased and whatever. So you have to remember too that as time corrupts, things become more problematic because of the genetic changes. For instance, earlier on, it's no problem to marry your sister. But as time goes along and the genetics change, that all of a sudden gene pool becomes so weakened that to marry your sister is to create anomalies that would be problematic. So, you know, early on, people are marrying close relatives without any boundaries whatsoever. But it's not until later that we get to the place where we can't do that anymore because of the genetic corruption. The world was corrupted in every way. It was corrupted physically. It was corrupted spiritually. It was corrupted mentally. Mental illness came into the world. Spiritual perversion came into the world. And the physical world, the world became dangerous. The earth itself was created, became changed in such a way as it became dangerous. Simple little things. In the garden, you had an ordered ecosystem. As soon as we get out of the garden, the brambles and the briars start taking over the earth, become dangerous places, you know. You've got, once you've got the flood, you've got cliffs to fall off of and stuff like that. You don't have all that. So as sin goes along and the earth becomes more and more corrupt, it becomes more and more dangerous. Never more so than in the gene pool. Because when people who are developing diseases and things like that begin to breed, they breed that into the genetics. And then the following generations have genetic flaws built into them, and they pass and morph. The book I wrote called Restored in God's Image talks about the fact that Adam and Eve just didn't fall. They fell from great heights. That Adam and Eve were super beings, creatures of extraordinary creation. They weren't you and me. They were something much more than you or me, much closer to God. We are mere shadows of Adam and Eve because we have been genetically twisted, bent, and corrupted and polluted down through the ages. Isaiah 11:1-9. Then, he's talking about in the millennial reign, a shoot will spring from the stem of Jesse. A branch from its roots will bear fruit, and the Spirit of the Lord will rest on him. Here he's actually talking about the birth of Christ. The Spirit of wisdom and understanding, Spirit of counsel and strength, Spirit of knowledge and fear of the Lord. And he will delight in the fear of the Lord, and he will not judge by what his eyes see, nor make a decision by what his ears hear. But with righteousness he will judge the poor, and decide with fairness for the afflicted of the earth. And he will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, the breath of his lips, he will slay the wicked. And also righteousness will be the belt about his loins, and faithfulness the belt about his waist. Remember, righteousness means right relationships. The wolf will dwell with the lamb, the leopard will lie down with the kid, the calf and the young lion, the fatling together, the little boy will lead them. The cow and the bear will graze, their young will lie down together, the lion will eat straw like the ox, the nursing child will play by the hole of the cobra, the weaned child will put his hand in the viper's den. They will not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Not yet happened, right? Must happen still, right?
Yeah.
Isaiah 65:17. Behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former things shall not be remembered to come to mind. But be glad and rejoice forever in what I create, for behold, I create Jerusalem for rejoicing, and her people for gladness. I will also rejoice in Jerusalem and be glad in my people. There will no longer be heard in her the voice of weeping and the sound of crying. No longer will there be an infant who lives but a few days, or an old man who does not live out his days. For the youth will die at the age of 100, and the one who does not reach the age of 100 shall be thought of as accursed. Remember those 900 year lifespans? Here they come again. They will build houses and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and eat their fruit. They shall not build and another inhabit. They shall not plant and another eat, for as the lifetime of a tree, so shall be the days of my people. And my chosen ones shall wear out the works of their hands. They'll live long enough that whatever they make will fall apart, and they'll have to make something else. As opposed to the fact that we have all these antiques in our homes that were made by people four generations back. Won't be that way. No one will have antiques, because they'll be outliving all their stuff. They shall wear out the work of their hands. They shall not labor in vain or bear children for calamity, for they are the offspring of those blessed by the Lord and their descendants with them. It will also come to pass, before they call, I will answer, and while they are still speaking, I will hear. And the wolf and the lamb will graze together, the lion will eat straw like the ox. The dust shall be the serpent's food. They shall do no evil or harm in all my holy mountain. These are visions of Isaiah about the time of the end. Millennial reign. Genesis 2:1-3. We'll stop and do some questions after this part. Thus the heavens and the earth were completed, and all their hosts. everything that's in the heavens and the earth. And on the seventh day, God completed his work which he had done. And he rested on the seventh day from all of his work which he had done. Then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because he rested from all of his work which God had created and made. So God creates the Sabbath as a blessing, not a burden. It's to be a day of rest for mankind, a day of fellowship between God and man and each other. The Sabbath rest is lost when man fell from God's peace, and restored when he becomes born again. Our personal rest in God is that condition that Adam and Eve had, where they walked in the garden and they were at peace and at rest with God. They were able to fellowship and talk with him and be with him. And that was lost when Adam and Eve fell. All of a sudden, their meetings with God became embarrassing. Their time with God became regretful. The stuff that happened between that they had to talk to God about became problematic. God, our son Cain has killed our son Abel. That's not a conversation you want to have. Can you imagine walking up on your dead son and you've never seen the dead? The only dead you've seen is dead animals. The Sabbath rest is lost when man fell from God's peace, and restored when he becomes born again. It's restored in potential. If we would just operate in it, it would be restored fully. The Sabbath is a metaphor for salvation. In it, we learn to quit striving to save ourselves and let God's grace and His Spirit do the work in us. So Hebrews talks about the rest, enter into the rest. He's talking about the salvation experience, the relational salvation experience. All salvation is based in relationship, the Sabbath relationship. Sabbath teaches us that only God can bring us peace. That is its purpose. That's when we have the seventh day, we're meant to sit around in fellowship, lakayim. Celebrate God, our relationship with God, our relationship with one another, the blessings of God, the life that He's given us. To be grateful, to be thankful, to enjoy, to mend fences, to... if we're operating in the Sabbath rest, it means we're honoring the Lord of the Sabbath, and so therefore we'll be obedient to the process of mending fences and, you know, doing the things that we should be doing. I don't mean mending fences physically, I mean mending fences relationally. But the Sabbath was meant for us to stop, take a breath, take a pause, remember God, remember what God wanted, intended, and whatever. You can play bridge on the Sabbath, it's okay. Golf is another matter. Just kidding. Okay, we got about 6 minutes before this thing's over. I think I'm going to stop here for tonight. But let's have some conversation. We've covered some ground.
I got a couple of questions.
Yeah.
God created Adam and Eve at 25, 20, 30, whatever age.
Yeah, something like that.
Time meant nothing.
No.
At that point.
Well, yes, it did. On Earth, they have time from the very beginning.
Okay, they had time.
Yeah.
So.
But they didn't age.
We didn't know.
But they didn't age.
Know how long the time span was before they sinned.
No, we don't. They could have been in the garden 100 years.
Right.
They could have been in the garden for 3 weeks.
Create others before the fall.
Well, apparently, because not create others. Adam and Eve had children, and apparently they had daughters first, because Cain and Abel had to marry somebody.
You said what was that last one?
Apparently, Adam and Eve had daughters first. When we read a little bit later on about the birth of Abel, Eve says, "At last I've got a man-child." So what the implication is that I've had these women children and now I've got a man-child. So if you think about the fact that Cain and Abel had to marry someone, and if you're true to the understanding that there's this one set of parents from which we came, I mean, even scientists agree that we all came from one set of parents. I mean, that's been an accepted theory for ever, genetically speaking. So what happens is if we came from the one set of parents, then Adam and then Cain and Abel had to marry their sisters. And it sort of matters not whether Abel was born one year and his sisters married the next year, and then he, you know, marries her when they're 17 or whatever. You know, that works. But the way she said, at last I've created a man-child. I mean, the word doesn't say I've created, I have had a child. It's a man-child. So the implication is they probably had daughters first. And we don't know how long they're in the garden. Remember, the text is a frozen section of a piece of history, and there's huge jumps there. So they may have been in the garden for 100 years. Maybe not. They may have been in the garden for 100 years and not had any children for 80 of those. I mean, we don't know what happened there. They may have been in the garden for 6 months and the fall came. Whatever. By the time we see Abel and Cain, they're both adult males. And by the time we see them getting married, they have no one else to marry but the offspring of Adam and Eve. Other comments or?
Along that line, if Adam and Eve could have had children when they were 80 or whatever.
Oh my goodness, they died in the 900s. If you when we read the genealogies later, we're going to see people having children in their 300s.
So maybe it wasn't such an anomaly, Abraham and Sarah having.
It was by the time we get to Abraham and Sarah. Because what happens is you can if you trace the timelines, what happens is people aren't living that long anymore. Besides Abraham, we're clearly told that Abraham and Sarah were beyond childbearing age, or that Sarah was. We're clearly told that. So by the time we get to that particular point, that's what I'm talking about, the genetic corruption. So Adam and Eve, we're told that people like Adam and Eve, that their natural force was unabated in their 900s. That they were able to function, you know, they weren't old yet. I mean, even people like Caleb, who was a kind of an unusual character, his natural force was unabated in his 80s. He conquered his territory in his 80s. Remember, he was a young man who went out as a spy, and then they wandered in the desert for 40 years. And by the time he got around to his territory, he was 80 years old. And he goes up against the Anak and the Nephilim, and he and his troops, they conquer the hill country. I mean, that's tough sledding. But it says his natural force was unabated. And we get that from time to time in Scripture. The Scripture tells us that someone's natural force is unabated. That means they're still young and vibrant, whatever. So we get this diminishment. You know, like for instance, Jacob was complaining to Pharaoh, and he said, I've been merely 110 years, or I think that was the number. He said, not long like my ancestors before me. You know, I didn't live long and healthy like my ancestors before me. Yeah, I'm a shriveled up, you know, old man at this age. You know, Jacob stopped having children long before that. I don't think it was for lack of trying. It could be that if he'd taken some younger wives on, he could have had more children. But by the time we get Bilhah, Zilpah, you know, of course Rachel dies early, and Leah, by the time we get them to a certain age, they stop bearing children. You know what that is with men. Men are capable of populating the whole earth, you know, whatever. But, you know, so at any rate, there's this diminishment. Men are beasts. Men are pigs. So, other comments?
The Sabbath thing.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Before, when you would say that the Sabbath now was all the time and resting in the Lord, I had a problem because I felt like, what about the commandment to remember the Sabbath and keep it holy?
Right.
But tonight when you were explaining it, it seemed to me more that remember your relationship, your salvation with the Lord, and keep your relationship with him holy. So instead of remembering it one day, it's a constant remembrance.
Well, except that, yeah, yes and no. I mean, as Christians, because we live in the Spirit, that's true. Remember, the word holy means set apart.
Yeah.
So he's saying, keep this one day set apart for God. So remember the Sabbath and keep it holy meant set apart for God.
Yeah.
Okay. So it depends on what you were thinking in terms of holy. We live in, as saved people, we live continuously in the Sabbath. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean that we wouldn't do well to take one day in seven and treat it as a Sabbath. Now, if you're a preacher or somebody and you got to work Sundays, you still need to take. I mean, Nancy and I have had, you know, our dating day and whatever. We've had our time for just us for forever, and we're frequently busy all day Sunday. But, you know, you've got to take time to have your relationships with your family and all that sort of thing. The Sabbath is it's a construct. Okay. But as far as the Jews goes, you know, he said to them, you'll never make it if you don't, you know, take time out of your schedule to set apart one day, celebrate your covenant, celebrate your relationship with me, celebrate your families. See?
Yeah.
Other...
Yeah, but he even showed him that in the land. He made him let fields lie fallow.
Yeah. That's right. He had the fields lie fallow every 7 years.
He's trying to teach him rest, too.
That's right. That's right. Try to teach them rest. And one of the problems that we have as people is we're always trying to save ourselves. So the Sabbath rest that Jesus brought to us is a rest from our labors of trying to save ourselves. That was an important understanding. God sent His Son to save us, and for us to continue to try to save ourselves is to strive. When we should be resting. In fact, the only thing the Bible tells us to strive about is to strive to enter the rest. Otherwise, striving is wrong. We're supposed to strive to enter the rest. In other words, get to the place where you are in the rest in terms of your relationship with God. I mean, from it flows things like God will provide us with the food we need. God will provide us with the things that we need. You know, we don't need to struggle. When a person goes out and works, you know, 70 hours a week and 7 days a week, because they are afraid that if they don't, they won't get what they need. There's a problem with that. Now, because, remember how everything corrupts? Well, part of what's corrupted is the whole business community, whereby they basically demand people work these long, long hours. You know, I don't know if you know this or not, but Americans work longer hours and have less time off than any other nation on the face of the earth. Now, there's a sense in which we are more productive, but you have to ask yourself what it is we are productive about. What we're doing is we are taking all this extra work so that we can live at a higher standard of possessions and resources. And we would be better off to have fewer possessions and resources and more relationship with God and our families. I mean, you know, you look at our particular world around us, and here in Alpharetta, Georgia, here in America, and we see this very high standard of living. But all of us, almost, I'm sure without exception, come from grandparents who didn't have that high standard of living, and parents who didn't have a standard of living, and did not have that high standard of living as we were growing up. And yet we were quite capable of enjoying our families, and we ate enough, and we had, you know, remember when entertainment used to be about sitting around and talking, or board games, you know, or, you know, doing stuff together? Teaching daughters how to can, you know, sons how to cut wood. I mean,
crocheting.
Yeah, well, just something different than this thing that feeds our hedonism, feeds our need for speed, you know, our need for pleasure and whatever.
It's really cool though. Today, I mean, we have an example with like Truett Cathy, who said he was closing his restaurants on Sabbath, you know, and God has blessed him.
Yeah, she's talking about Truett Cathy closing his restaurant on the Sabbath, and God's blessed him. So we can see the standard of living that we have, and we can say, well, that's a good thing. But at what cost? You know, I mean, the entire struggle that we have right now and our whole political system is because of a distribution of resources that is not equitable and fair. If some of us had less and others had more, we might have more harmony. I mean, if that was done in a voluntary, you know, godly way. I mean, I think that for the government to try to come in and take it from us is wrong on several levels. First of all, it's not their job to do that. And secondly, they'll just waste it. But we are nonetheless called to make sure that everyone has a roof over their head and food to eat and the necessities of life, you know, from what we have. And one person can easily have more than the next person, but it should not be at the expense of someone else starving to death. You know, what we have a scenario right now is where, in order to provide for basic necessities, both husband and wife have to work. Because, I mean, if you have a modest home and you want your children to go to school and you need a modest automobile, you still can't do it on 40, 50 grand. You can't do it. Not going into debt because of what's going on. So in order for people to even deal with a modest set of, taxes. Taxes are, you know, they're now going to approach about 40%. So at any rate, I've gone to preaching. Somebody pray us out, I guess.